From the studios of Kootenai Co-op Radio, this is Deconstructing Dinner.
When we think about food, we think about it in a fairly narrow way.
If we take apart and analyze our food, we might then start to recognize the value of food in our lives.
Welcome to Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated weekly one-hour radio show and podcast produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY, in Nelson, British Columbia, and currently making its way across the country by tricycle. And you'll learn more about that in just a moment. I'm John Steinman, and I'll be your host for the next hour. On today's broadcast, we'll continue to examine the recent global food crisis that is receiving widespread media attention. In particular, we'll listen in on a speech delivered by President George W. Bush on May 1st when he addressed how the United States would respond to the crisis. And of further interest, we'll listen in on his and the U.S. foreign policy definition of food security. While global efforts to respond to the food crisis may indeed be providing much-needed aid to large populations of people, it is this very aid and its accompanying policies that is suggested will only further push this food crisis to even more damaging proportions. In the end, the food aid effort is the very same one that has persisted for decades, and let's face it, it hasn't worked. Lending their voice to help critically examine Bush's speech will be a familiar voice on the show, Anuradha Mittal, the executive director of the Oakland Institute based in Oakland, California. And also on the show today, we meet Derek Hahn and Sanisha Grigic, two cyclists who on May 7th departed Victoria, BC to embark on a cross-Canada tour. Both are currently making their way across British Columbia on recumbent tricycles. And you may be asking, how has this anything to do with food? Well, Derek and Sanisha are using their trip as an opportunity to promote this radio program, Deconstructing Dinner. The pair will be meeting local farmers, eating local food, and on today's show, we'll learn more about why they've chosen such a cause and how their trip is going thus far. It was, needless to say, a unique offer that we received back in January of this year when two cyclists who were planning to cycle across the country approached us with the interest to use their trip as a means to help raise awareness of this very show, Deconstructing Dinner. Well, as this show goes to air, Derek Hahn and Sanisha Grigic are en route between Grand Forks and Nelson, BC, following days of grueling mountain passes, tasty food, and generous down-home Canadian hospitality. Over the next few months, we'll be airing updates on how their trip is progressing, the interesting foods that are being consumed, and we'll learn of the many faces of Canadian agriculture that can be found from coast to coast. Linked to from the Deconstructing Dinner website is a blog where Derek and Sanisha are keeping a journal and collection of photos, and that can be linked to from our website at either of our new website addresses, deconstructingdinner.com or deconstructingdinner.ca. And you can expect a more in-depth interview with Derek and Sanisha once they arrive here in Nelson and get pulled into our studios. But meeting up with them in Victoria on May 7th was correspondent Andrea Langlois, who interviewed both of them at the zero-mile mark of the Trans-Canada Highway just prior to their departure across the country. After this short segment, we'll listen in on some more clips from a phone conversation I had with Derek early this morning on the day this broadcast first goes to air, and he spoke to me from an organic dairy in the agricultural community of Grand Forks. But before we get to that, here's Andrea Langlois.
This is Andrea Langlois. I'm at Mile Zero here in Victoria. I'm the Deconstructing Dinner correspondent for Vancouver Island, and I'm sitting here with Sanisha Grigic and Derek Hahn, who are about to cycle across the country, and while they do it, raise awareness for Deconstructing Dinner. So you just did your first leg of the journey today. How did it feel?
It felt pretty good. We did approximately 70K, and with a couple of breaks here, and the weather certainly helped us along as things turned quite sunny and warm once we got on the island. And we feel really good about what we're going to be doing when we take off for the rest of the country.
All right, so I'm sure the question in everyone's mind is, why would you want to bike across the country? What's the motivation?
Well, Sanisha and I have known each other for many years, and we've always been talking about seeing Canada one way or another. And we'd entertain different ways. We thought about hiking, but hiking would just plain take too long. Driving, the novelty, it just didn't feel right. You wouldn't really soak things in. And then while I was commuting to and from work in Vancouver, I thought that this would be the perfect mode of transportation. It wouldn't be too fast, but it definitely wouldn't be too slow. And when I presented the idea to Sanisha, he was pretty excited about it.
So maybe, Sanisha, you can tell us about how you feel about setting out on this journey.
I always kind of wanted to run away a little bit, just enjoy the nature for a few months and not have the worries of everyday life and just kind of put everything in the background and enjoy the scenery, basically.
So what's the link between your road trip and deconstructing dinner and food security?
I came across John Steinman and his show at a music festival last summer where he was doing a little presentation promoting his show. And I had known him several years ago back at the University of Guelph. And I came across him, and he filled me in on his show. From there, I tuned in, listened to his show, and after a couple, I found that a lot of my values were aligned with what he was talking about and discussing on a weekly basis. From there, as we were developing our plans for the bike trip, it just seemed like a natural progression to include this opportunity to present a whole new way of looking at food and food production to our fellow Canadians as we cross the country. And also, being as that I grew up on a farm, I was born and raised, the plight of the farmer and the state of our agricultural system is always something that I keep in mind on a regular basis. And hearing John's approach and essentially being a voice for the farmer has been a real positive thing in my sense.
So we know that, you know, there's people across the country getting more and more interested in food security issues. How will it look to connect with people across the country? What are you hoping will happen?
I'm hoping a lot of people will actually stop and really listen to what we have to say and ultimately what the show presents. It's something where Sanisha and I both kind of understand the issues with our health problems in society and then also issues with food. People should want to know what's going into their food, and I think there are a lot of people that do, and unfortunately mainstream media doesn't do a good enough job doing that. If they had an opportunity to gain knowledge on what John presents, I think a lot of people would really go for it.
All right, so where are you heading first?
Well, after we take off from Mile Zero, we're going to be heading to Vancouver, and we'll be resting there. And then from there, we're heading east.
Heading east. Heading to the home of Deconstructing Dinner in the Kootenays, I hear?
Essentially, yes. We are going to be ultimately in Nelson. If anybody listening has been there, it is a stunning, beautiful town, and can't wait to soak up some of the sights and the culture.
So I'm assuming that the listeners will be able to follow you through the show, but you're also going to have a blog. How are you going to do that while you're on the road?
I have chosen to bring a computer that I will be updating on a daily basis, and whenever I get an access to internet, I will be uploading the site and sharing stories and experiences along the way, and hopefully people will be able to tune in. And
so what's the web address for your blog?
Our blog address is www.fresh-entertainment.ca.
So I guess, too, going across the country gives the 100-mile diet a whole different spin. Are you hoping to eat a lot of local food while you make your way across the country?
It certainly is our goal to eat as much local food. We're also entertaining the idea of trying to live off the land, essentially, or find like local plants that are edible as we go along. Well, we'll see how it works out. This is a really big country, and especially with the current food system, we'll learn pretty quickly how accessible local food is.
That's great. Derek and Sanisha, do you have anything else to add for our listeners as you head off on your journey?
I think everybody should check out our site, see how we're making out, and more importantly, listen to Deconstructing Dinner.
Well, I have a feeling that as these guys go up those big hills, they're going to need listeners to be writing them encouragement. So I encourage everyone to get on there and give a little push and listen to Deconstructing Dinner to see how Derek and Sanisha are doing.
And that was Andrea Langlois, a correspondent for Deconstructing Dinner based in Victoria, BC. And since that interview was recorded on May 7th, Derek and Sanisha are, as of May 15th, cycling between Grand Forks and the home of this show in Nelson, BC. A Along the way, the pair have stopped in Vancouver, Agassiz, Hope, Manning Park, Headley, and DeSoyuz. A detailed journey of their trip can again be found on the Deconstructing Dinner website, but I did catch up with Derek over the phone following his breakfast of boiled eggs that he gathered just 2 days prior from a farmer in the Similkameen Valley. Derek spoke to me from inside the cheesemaking facility of Jerseyland Organics, a business that was featured here on the program back in 2007 as part of our Deceivable Dairy series. And Jerseyland produces cheese, butter, sour cream, and yogurt products.
Currently, I'm in the Jerseyland Organics cheesemaking facility and specifically their packaging area. But in the next room, there's a big vat where the mixers are going to make cheese. And then we just got a tour of the whole facility where there's a huge area where they're aging their cheese, and then there's their cold storage for their yogurt, which is, this is all raw milk products. So yeah, it's been a real treat to see it in development. They've just undergone a bit of a renovation, making their capacity a little bit bigger.
Now, jumping back to where that last interview with Andrea Langlois ended, Derek recounts how that first leg of the trip between Victoria and Vancouver turned out.
Now, that day, we actually biked from Vancouver to Victoria and then back to Vancouver, and that has been our longest day so far. It was about 166 kilometers of biking, and it could have been a little bit shorter, but we didn't make it back to take the shuttle under the Massey Tunnel in time, so we actually had to take the long way around and go across the Alex Fraser Bridge. And it was a pretty grueling day. I was carrying about half my weight that I was going to be riding for the trip. By the end of it, we were ready for a rest, and in fact, we rested the next day, and it was a good taste of what we were going to be encountering, and I decided to change some of my gear. Tanisha wanted to do some changes and improvements to his bike as his rear view mirror fell off.
Following a rest stop in Vancouver, Derek and Sunisha headed out through the congestion of the city and into the agricultural lands of the Fraser Valley. Their destination was the community of Agassiz and a hazelnut farm called Canadian Hazelnuts.
Yeah, just outside Agassiz is where we stopped. There was a little, it was Kilby Provincial Park is where we stopped. And we wanted to try to make it to the Canadian Hazelnut farm that night, but we were pretty tired. We'd put in a long day, and we were about 10 kilometers away from the farm, and we found out we had another hill to climb, and it was fairly significant. We decided we'd rather get some rest and tackle it in the morning and then just set up camp.
The community of Agassiz is surrounded by agricultural land, and a significant number of farms there cultivate hazelnuts, not the most common type of farm here in Canada. And needless to say, the two cyclists had not expected to encounter a hazelnut farm on their cross-Canada journey.
Never even imagined that we would be coming across a hazelnut farm. We saw the opportunity and decided to check it out, and that was really interesting. Coming from a farming perspective, where I grew up on a farm, to see how a hazelnut farm is operated was interesting. I think he's doing all right on his farm there. He's got a good market picked out where there's not so many hazelnuts being able to be produced. In Canada, the Agassiz area is known as a hazelnut growing area, and I think he's fortunate to have the right climate to successfully grow them on a large scale.
After loading up on hazelnuts, Derek and Sunisha stopped over in the town of Hope and then headed out of the Fraser Valley and into the mountains. And it was then that the real test of Derek and Sunisha's tricycles began.
Yeah, you know what? It was climbing the Allison Pass and then making it to the top of the Sunday Summit. Those were memorable in their own right. The Allison Pass, memorable strictly because it was snowing when we got to the top. This was our first pass, and I think after we were done that, our confidence level as cyclists increased significantly. We didn't know how our bikes would perform in the mountains. We didn't know how we'd perform in the mountains. Things were feeling pretty good, and then the downhill slope into Princeton was a whole lot of fun. And then on top of that, that day was an action-packed day, because just before we got into Princeton, we met our first newspaper journalist who stopped us on the road, and we just came up to someone, pulled over, and snapping pictures at us, And then Carla Clark of the Similkameen Spotlight stopped in and gave us a little interview. And she's since called and touched base to find out how we're doing. I haven't had a chance to contact her yet, but that was real nice and real interesting as she was talking about the Princeton area actually recently having a meeting on food security. So the topic of food security is something that's on a lot of people's minds in the area.
Now, one of the more amusing conversations I had with Derek and Sunisha before they embarked on their journey was with respect to what they should do if they run out of food and only have access to highly processed fast food, which, let's face it, on the Trans-Canada Highway is the standard fare. We agreed that two cyclists walking out of a Tim Hortons or a Burger King and hopping on their trikes adorned with Deconstructing Dinner signs would look rather out of place. Well, Derek and Sunisha faced this dilemma once they arrived in the community of Princeton because staring them down there was a Dairy Queen.
At the Manning Park Resort, we stayed for the night before, and we met a wonderful Aussie couple who are also cycling. They're cycling from Vancouver Island to Toronto. When we got into, we told them we'd contact them when we got into Princeton, and when we got there, we called them, and they were at the Dairy Queen, and it was a gorgeous day. It was hot, and we were visiting outside for a while there, and we actually met a couple other people, and they were all enjoying Dairy Queen treats and everything, and I'm sitting in the sun, and it's like, oh, it's hot, and that stuff looks really good, and my biking partner, Sunisha, just started heading in, and he said, do you want anything? And I said, I can't. I got to hold off. The main reason being is because we are promoting Deconstructing Dinner, and the concept of fast food is pretty much a, well, blatant hypocrisy if we're going to be carrying Deconstructing Dinner signs on our bike. So I just said, I can't really do that. And he's like, yeah, you're right. We can't do that. So instead, we held off and just went to one of the local variety stores, and although it's not much of a better choice, we did grab an ice cream treat there. But I guess trying to support a local venue owner rather than a market chain was, I guess, the lesser of the two evils.
Luckily for Derek and Sunisha, it was only 30 kilometers later that they were to meet their hosts for the evening in the community of Headley, located in the Similkameen Valley. Now, because I had only a few contacts in the area, I decided to get in touch with the organizer of a recent food security event that took place in neighboring Princeton to see if any unique farms were willing to host the two cyclists. Sure enough, my contact there was a fan of the show, and so was a friend of hers in Headley, and their hosts had already been planning a local meal of indigenous foods for that same evening Derek and Sunisha were around. Arriving. As Derek described it, the meal amounted to one of the most local meals they'll likely have on their trip.
Definitely, and on top of that, probably one of the most amazing experiences we'll have. Sunisha and I both are still stunned at the level of hospitality we received in Headley. Our host, Angelique Wood, and unfortunately I didn't catch any of the last names of everybody else, but a couple of neighbors in the community, their names being Terry. He is a hunter in the area and big advocate of local food and encouraging people to be reconnected with the earth. And then we ate dinner at a lady by the name of Shirley at her place, and she made some homemade bannock for us. And then one of the neighbors as well, Sue, who is a retired teacher, that came in and pitched in with Saskatoon berry pie. And on top of that, those two items, we were able to enjoy some wild rice that was grown in Ontario but made with a recipe based in Manitoba. We also had some quail à l'orange, which was delicious. The quail had been caught or hunted by Terry, as well as a bit of a duck medley. We had also some local asparagus, and there's one other thing, and the Jerusalem artichokes, which I believe were grown in one of maybe Angelique's garden, but I'm not sure. One of the people's gardens. It was grown there, and it was harvested last fall, and they kept amazingly over the winter, so they were delicious.
Derek added that the meal was also enjoyed with many locally produced wines, which the Similkameen and Okanagan Valleys are well known for. Derek also added that Headley is definitely worth a visit because, as he says, quote, they're just great people. And I'd also personally like to extend a big thanks to the hosts for helping support their journey across the country and helping in the effort to raise awareness of this show. Now, next on the journey following Headley was a cycle through the Similkameen Valley, which is likely the most organically minded agricultural area in the country. It is said that at least 50% of all of the farms in the valley grow organically, with much of the production being fruit and wine grapes. After descending into the Okanagan Valley, Derek and Sinisha fielded yet some more media attention with the Osoyoos Times and an Okanagan commercial radio station, both eager to learn more about their trip and about the show. Derek described some of his observations while taking on that leg of the trip.
Other than the stunning views and watching the differences in, say, climate, say the lower mainland, where you know you have a lot of farming and you could even say a little bit more industrialized farming, to coming into a lot of the valleys that have been on our trip, where you come across a lot of irrigation that's taking place. Like when we were traveling from Headley to Osoyoos, it was raining that day, and yet people were still irrigating the soil, which told me that they need a lot of water. And even speaking to Jeremy, who's our host here at Jersey Land Organics, he said we really needed the rain, so it was much welcomed. And then they irrigate here as well, which coming from where I grew up, like, we take for granted how much timely rain we get, and rarely, if ever, need to irrigate our land, as well as like all the vineyards. Obviously, we got a little bit into the Okanagan Valley, and it's definitely a lot to soak in.
Along with taking in the sights and interacting with local foodies and farmers, the trip is, of course, in part being used to raise awareness of this nationally syndicated radio show. And Derek shared with me some of the responses received from onlookers.
A lot of people are really intrigued by our trikes, our recumbent trikes. So they're, you know, the common questions are, is how are those to ride, or what are they? And we'll take a minute to explain that, and then usually it moves on to, oh, deconstructing dinner, what's that? And then we'll explain a little bit about deconstructing dinner and encourage them to check out the site, or I give them a flyer that I have. And most of the time we get a pretty warm response from people. Cars driving by, we get countless honks and people waving at us, and a lot of bikers give us a little wave as well. So it's been really fun just being on the road that way. We've been asked, like, how fast can we get them up to, or what are they like on the hills?
And again, Derek spoke to me over the phone from inside the cheese-making facility of Jersey Land Organics, an organic dairy located in Grand Forks, B.C. And it was an inspiring stop for the two cyclists, as the business is a rare but important example of how there are indeed opportunities for farmers to earn a living doing what they do, a promising sign in a country where farming is heading in the completely opposite direction.
When we stop at a place like where we are at Jersey Land Organics, is a chance to see, in this case, a rather successful organic dairy farm in operation. Like I was talking with Jeremy last night, he made a good point. It's important that people can see this, because there's a lot of farmers that may not know that this option's available, and that seeing the success of it, they know they could make a go of it themselves.
And that was Derek Hahn speaking from Grand Forks, B.C. And over the next few months, you can expect to hear much more about Derek and Sinisha Grigic's cross-Canada bike tour that is being used to raise awareness of deconstructing dinner. Their arrival into Nelson will come in the latter half of Thursday, May 15th, if all goes as planned. And so for anyone in the Nelson area, you can keep your eyes peeled for them coming into town from Castlegar, and you can't miss them as they're riding on three-wheel recumbent cycles. And once they get into town, the All Seasons Cafe has generously invited them for a Friday night dinner as a kind gesture of support for their efforts and for the show. And on Saturday, you can catch them at the Cottonwood Falls Market in the morning before they head towards Balfour. And again, that's Saturday, May 17th. I'd also like to thank the Kootenai Country Store Cooperative here in town, who are too helping support Derek and Sinisha's cross-Canada adventure by donating 1% of sales on June 17th to their trip. And so Nelson area residents, be sure to plan your shopping on that date. And again, you can check out their periodically updated journal and photos by linking to them from our website at deconstructingdinner.ca. And for our listeners all across the country, if you're listening from a location that may be on their route, send us your suggestions as to what Derek and Sinisha should check out as they maybe cycle through your town. And those ideas can be sent to deconstructingdinner@cjly.net. And in taking a brief musical intermission before we hear from President George W. Bush and the Oakland Institute's Anuradha Mittal, Here's a piece in honor of Derek and Sinisha's Trans-Canada journey. And this track is created by the Scottish duo known as Boards of Canada and is off their album Trans-Canada Highway. This is Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated weekly one-hour radio program and podcast produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY, in Nelson, British Columbia. I'm John Steinman. That musical intermission was courtesy of the Scottish duo Boards of Canada and is taken off of their album, Trans-Canada Highway. A quick update on what to expect on our next episode of the show. We'll be revisiting with Bill C-517, which was introduced in the House of Commons last February and was calling for the mandatory labeling of foods containing genetically engineered ingredients. That show will conclude our coverage of the bill, as it was on May 7th that the bill was voted on, and lending their voice to that show will be Liberal Member of Parliament and Agriculture critic Wayne Easter, Conservative MP Rob Merrifield, and Greenpeace Agriculture campaigner Josh Brandon, among others. And I'd call that upcoming broadcast one of the most important ones that we will have aired to date, as it takes much of the critical coverage that we've aired here on the GMO or GE topic and places this topic directly into the hands of politicians, something we haven't done very much of here on the show, and understandably, as it's a topic that has not been debated in Parliament on many occasions. And you'll be shocked to hear the sheer lack of knowledge that was exhibited in the House during the May 5th debate on the bill. But on to the next segment of today's broadcast. We'll be taking a listen to President George W. Bush speaking on May 1st. And this segment takes off from my recent commentary that was shared a few episodes ago on the role of the media in covering the latest global food crisis. However, today we'll examine the role of governments who are responding to this crisis, and in particular the United States. As has been raised here on the program before, the standard response to global hunger and food shortages has long been the same, and that is to provide food aid. Now, while such aid is indeed needed in the short term, it is far from what's required in the long term. And in the end, U.S. food aid is a boon to the U.S. economy and U.S. foreign interests. The role of U.S. aid is no secret, and stated right on their website is the following, quote, "Foreign assistance is a valuable foreign policy tool in terms of promoting U.S. security interests and its economic interests," end quote. The motives of food aid are quite clear. Lending their voice to the show following this segment from May 1st will be Anuradha Mittal of the Oakland Institute, based in Oakland, California. And Anuradha will be commenting on Bush's statements. And so here's President Bush speaking on May 1st from Washington, D.C.
In recent weeks, many have expressed concern about the significant increase in global food prices. And I share that concern. In some of the world's poorest nations, rising prices can mean the difference between getting a daily meal or going without food. To address this problem, 2 weeks ago, my administration announced that about $200 million in emergency food aid would be available through a program at the Agriculture Department called the Emerson Trust. But that's just the beginning of our efforts. I think more needs to be done. And so today I'm asking Congress to provide an additional $770 million to support food aid and development programs. Together, this amounts to nearly $1 billion in new funds to bolster global food security. And with other security assistance programs already in place, we're now projecting to spend nearly $5 billion in 2008 and 2009 to fight global hunger. This funding will keep our existing emergency food aid programs robust. We have been the leader for providing food to those who are going without in the past, and we will continue to be the leader around the world. We'll also allow us to fund agricultural development programs that help farmers in developing countries increase their productivity. And, of course, this will help reduce the number of people who need emergency food aid in the first place. As America increases its food assistance, it's really important that we transform the way that food aid is delivered. In my State of the Union address this year, I called on Congress to support a proposal to purchase up to nearly 25% of food assistance directly from farmers in the developing world. And the reason you do that is in order to break the cycle of famine that we're having to deal with too often in the modern era, it's important to help build up local agriculture. I ask Congress to approve this measure as soon as possible. It's a common sense way to help deal with food emergencies around the world. Now, other countries have a role to play as well. America's in the lead, we'll stay in the lead, and we expect others to participate along with us. We're working with our G8 partners and other developed nations to secure commitments from their governments for additional food aid. We're also working toward the conclusion of a successful Doha agreement that will reduce and eliminate tariffs and other barriers, as well as market-distorting subsidies for agricultural goods. And the reason why getting a Doha round done is important, is it'll end up reducing the cost of food, importing food, to make it cheaper for consumers all around the world. In other words, we want to change the system to make it easier for people to get less expensive food. We're also urging countries that have instituted restrictions on agricultural exports to lift those restrictions. Some countries are preventing needed food from getting to market in the first place. We call upon them to end those restrictions to help ease suffering for those who aren't getting food. We're also urging countries to remove barriers to advanced crops developed through biotechnology. These crops are safe, they're resistant to drought and disease, and they hold the promise of producing more food for more people. Now, here at home, we're working to ensure that our poorest citizens get the food they need. Since 2001, the administration, working with Congress, has increased funding for nutrition assistance programs by 76%. We've adjusted food stamp benefits annually to cover price increases at the checkout counter. And last month, the Agriculture Department made available an additional $150 million to respond to the food needs of those who depend on WIC, the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children. With this new funding, we will have increased our support for WIC by 18.6% this year. The American people are generous people and they're compassionate people. We believe in the timeless truth, to whom much is given, much is expected. And so therefore at home, we will work to ensure that the neediest among us can cope with the rising food prices. And with the new international funding I'm announcing today, we're sending a clear message to the world that America will lead the fight against hunger for years to come. Thank you very much for your interest. God bless.
And that was President Bush speaking on May 1st from the Diplomatic Reception Room in Washington, D.C. In August of 2006, the Oakland Institute's Anuradha Mittal lent her voice to Deconstructing Dinner as part of our episode titled The Solidarity of Others is Our Own Defense. After working as the co-director of Food First, or otherwise known as the Institute for Food and Development Policy, Anuradha established the Oakland Institute in 2004 in Oakland, California. The Institute is a policy think tank whose mission is to increase public participation and promote fair debate on critical social, economic, and environmental issues in both national and international forums. Anuradha is currently the Institute's executive director. In helping unearth the flaws in Bush's speech and his model of addressing hunger, we can narrow in on his use of the term food security. Clearly, this is a term used often here on the program, and one which, in the case of its use on our shows, is far different from the version espoused by Bush. Instead, it appears that Bush's definition of food security is one of food dependence. And Anuradha spoke to me over the phone while in London, England.
Well, you know, it's very interesting that we find terms such as food security being used by the White House and, of course, President Bush. But I think we have to take it with a pinch of salt. The way food security is defined by the U.S. government and the current administration is very different the way social movements, NGOs would describe this terminology with, because they see food security just being implemented through aid programs. But we are talking really about food sovereignty, about ensuring countries and people's rights to be able to grow food and conduct agriculture in ways that are ecologically, socially, and economically appropriate for them. We are talking about small farmers being the stewards of the land. We are talking about small farmers' access and control over food-producing resources such as seed, water, lands. And we cannot say that we are on the same agenda here.
Yet another reference made by Bush was with respect to that of local agriculture, certainly a term not often uttered by the President of the United States. In this case in particular, Bush's use of the word was following his calling upon Congress to support a proposal to purchase up to nearly 25% of food assistance directly from farmers in the developing world. Bush insists that such a measure will help, quote, break the cycle of famine. And Anuradha Mittal points out that 25% is not very high at all.
Well, it is good to see President Bush talk about demand that many of us have been campaigning and advocating for. At the Oakland Institute, we have called for 25% of U.S. food aid to be used to buy food locally from the local food producers in the recipient countries. And it's actually not asking for very much. If you look at some of the other industrialized nations, EU, for example, is procuring nearly 96% of its food aid You know, locally, Canada has moved to nearly 50%, and U.S. remains one of the few industrialized countries that refuses to support agriculture, to support small farmers in recipient countries by buying food aid locally. So in that context, a local agriculture, one would hope, is really about procuring food aid from the local farmers. It is not really about procuring food aid locally from the international agribusiness corporations such as Cargill, ADM, and the others.
Coming back to the statement made on the USAID website that reads, foreign assistance is a valuable foreign policy tool in terms of promoting U.S. economic interests. The refusal to purchase food aid from so-called developing countries allows for some companies to earn a pretty decent living from hunger.
Well, because the United States has not changed the way it conducts its food aid program, you know, it still insists on buying food aid from the U.S. agribusiness corporations, which is then packaged and shipped by the U.S. shipping vessels, as enshrined in the 1985 Farm Bill, which requires, you know, most of the food aid to be shipped by the U.S. shipping vessels. The money that we are talking about would basically be pocketed by the same corporations and shipping vessels. And as we know, as the Government Accountability Office report pointed out last year, this results in making U.S. food aid, first of all, be late by almost 6 months, but at the same time, it increases the cost of food aid by almost 100%. So we're talking about, with increasing food prices, very little actually getting to the communities that we think it is supposed to help.
What stands out is one of the more chilling statements presented by Bush was his reference to the long-term sustainability of food aid instead of the long-term sustainability of food sovereignty and food security, the one that we normally use here on the show. And here's that clip again.
And with other security assistance programs already in place, we're now projecting to spend nearly $5 billion in 2008 and 2009 to fight global hunger. This funding will keep our existing emergency food aid programs robust. We have been the leader for providing food to those who are going without in the past, and we will continue to be the leader.
I asked Anuradha Mittal if the promise of long-term food aid is instead succumbing to the battle with hunger instead of continuing to fight it.
Well, when the administration talks about continuing food aid programs, it is indeed unfortunate that, you know, on one hand, it is good to see that we acknowledge that there is hunger, that the hunger is increasing, and we need to do something about it immediately. But at the same time, there's a lack of will, and I would say political will, to change policies which in the long term would end hunger, which would make a dent in hunger. We all know that hunger is a result of decisions, human decisions, and which is the good news, because these are not natural disasters. These are not something supernatural that cannot be changed by us. And in that context, it's very important to be questioning and challenging our policymakers in countries such as the United States, that how do we have a long-term perspective and how do we ensure those policies that would guarantee the human right to food for all in third world countries.
Yet another common statement made when foreign policy steps in to deal with hunger is the promise of increasing the productivity of farmers in the so-called developing world. This too was made in Bush's speech, and as expected, the term productivity often means dollar signs for U.S. economic interests.
Well, that's a real problematic area, because when we start hearing it, you know, about increasing productivity in third world nations, next we hear technological solutions such as we're hearing right now, the green revolution for Africa, revolutions based on chemical inputs such as fertilizers, herbicides, and the new green revolution being based on the, you know, biotechnology and genetic engineering. And it really deviates our attention from two causes behind hunger, assuming that merely increasing production will result in enough food for all human beings. I mean, even when we have had enough food to be able to provide enough kilocalories per person, we have seen increasing hunger. And if it was just a matter of production, we would not have hunger in a rich country such as the United States, where according to USDA, nearly 39 million people are food insecure. So right now the debate is should not have to be about how do we increase production, and especially again use this as a, you know, world food price crisis as an opportunity to promote technological solutions, which in the end benefit agribusiness corporations such as Monsanto and the others, who are already projecting huge profits from this world price crisis. So I think it is very important to not deviate our attention from the true causes behind hunger, and at the same time not take up all the space in terms of alternatives that exist to promote small-scale sustainable agriculture.
We hope that you're finding today's broadcast of Deconstructing Dinner a valuable resource of information. This program is distributed weekly, free of charge, and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Should you wish to ensure a perpetual harvest of Deconstructing Dinner, we kindly ask for your financial support through our website at cjly.net/deconstructingdinner or by dialing 250-352-9600.
And this is Deconstructing Dinner, where we're listening to clips from my conversation with the Oakland Institute's Anuradha Mittal as she comments on President Bush's May 1st speech on the role of the United States in dealing with the latest spike in global food shortages, price increases, and hunger. Also standing out in Bush's speech was his encouragement for countries to remove, quote, market-distorting tariffs and subsidies. Bush's calling on countries to remove tariffs is of great concern in that by doing so, countries will increasingly become dumping grounds for cheap commodities, which would only further increase the destruction of local agriculture and further increase food dependence.
Well, I would first of all contest that, again, the world food price crisis has become an opportunity for the U.S. administration to not just promote corporate interests through the Green Revolution technologies, but also an opportunity to promote the Doha negotiations of the World Trade Organization as a way to solve the current food price crisis and to make a dent in hunger. Now, it's a bit of a joke because even the World Bank estimates show that the complete conclusion of the Doha negotiations would actually increase food prices of rice, wheat, and basic staples. And it is exactly those kind of policies of trade liberalization that have removed tariffs in third world countries, which have turned them into dumping grounds for cheap subsidized commodities coming from rich nations such as the U.S., which has destroyed the ability to feed themselves, which has destroyed livelihoods of small family farmers, which is the cause of this widespread hunger. So suggesting that the Doha negotiations would make an impact is a false assumption to make. In fact, it would aggravate and further increase hunger in third world nations among the poor and lead to further displacement of poor farmers.
Bush's comments on subsidies and tariffs also raises an eyebrow upon recognizing that the United States subsidizes their agriculture more than any other country in the world. And to suggest that those subsidies would disappear seems rather utopian.
In terms of the U.S. subsidies, I think we have to look at the U.S. Farm Bill, which is which should have been approved last year, but it has been in a stalemate in the U.S. Congress and Senate. And the proposals that are under consideration do not show any political will to let go of the huge big subsidies that go to, you know, agribusiness corporations. So business would stay as usual. What we are hearing is a lot of lies, I would say, from the U.S. administration in terms of wanting to conclude the Doha negotiations. And because there is no such thing as creating a level playing field will in this administration.
So what is the answer to the ongoing global food crisis? How else could this $5 billion, for example, announced by Bush for 2008-2009, be used to combat global hunger? Anuradha shares her thoughts on this.
Well, definitely in terms of resources, I mean, yes, there is one immediate need, which is of providing aid to communities who are in need. But also, this money could be used for promoting true agrarian reform in third world countries. And by that, I mean things such as land reform, by ensuring support for small farmers, all the programs which have been removed in third world countries. It could be used for, building up and boosting grain reserves in third world countries, especially in the current crisis. There's a real need to talk about, you know, maintaining and building national stocks in third world countries, which have been decimated, again, thanks to the policies of the international financial institutions, which have been backed by rich nations such as the United States. So there are many creative ways of using this money, which could really ensure food sovereignty of nations in the long term.
One of the responses by many countries to the latest global food crisis has been the enacting of restrictions on agricultural exports with the hope that those countries can better satisfy the food needs of their population. Well, this, of course, upsets U.S. foreign interests. And in closing out my conversation with Anuradha Mittal of the Oakland Institute, she commented on such protective measures.
So it will require real political will. More important, it will require ensuring political and policy space to third world nations to take measures, whether it is ensuring grain reserves, whether it is providing support to their local farmers, ensuring local markets, promoting consumption of local crops, promoting sustainable agriculture, whatever it takes. That policy space has to be provided to third world nations so they can move ahead with their agenda of fulfilling human right to food in their own, you know, within the national boundaries. We are beginning to see some of those measures being taken now. For example, India, Vietnam, other countries who are placing export bans to ensure that they can first, you know, fulfill domestic needs and needs of the poor and hungry in their own countries. Those kind of measures have to be respected, have to be supported, instead of criticisms that we have seen coming their way.
And here again is George W. Bush whining about the way in which countries are trying to protect their own people.
We're also urging countries that have instituted restrictions on agricultural exports to lift those restrictions. Some countries are preventing needed food from getting to market in the first place. We call upon them to end those restrictions to help ease suffering for those who aren't getting food.
And that was President George W. Bush speaking on May 1st, 2008 from the White House. And also lending their voice was Anuradha Mittal, the executive director of the Oakland Institute. And you can learn more about the Institute and access a wealth of important resources by visiting their website at www.oaklandinstitute.org. And in closing out today's broadcast, it seems fitting to end it with a short clip from a recently released film by well-known investigative journalist John Pilger. The U.S. response to the latest global food crisis is a clear picture of where the real motives lie in the U.S. aid program. While it's become commonplace to accuse countries like the United States and Canada as only acting with selfish economic interests, it's not often that politicians or bureaucrats come out and directly admit this to indeed be true. Released this year was an eye-opening film titled The War on Democracy, created by John Pilger. It was during that film that Pilger poses a question to Duane Claridge, who was with the CIA between 1955 and 1987 when he retired from the CIA after being formally reprimanded for his role in the Iran-Contra affair. Claridge was questioned in the film on his role in the U.S.-led coup on Chilean President Salvador Allende, and his chilling response paints the clear picture of the role of the United States around the world.
What right have you, when I mean you, the CIA, the United States government, or any foreign power, what right do you have to do what you do in other countries?
National security interests.
But that's a divine right, isn't it? Because the people that you do it to have no say in this.
Well, that's just tough. We are going to protect ourselves, and we're going to go on protecting ourselves because we end up protecting all of you. And let's not forget that.
Right. No, I won't.
We'll intervene whenever we decide it's in our national security interest to intervene. And if you don't like it, lump it. Get used to it. World, we're not going to put up with nonsense. And if our interests are threatened, we're going to do it.
And that was this week's edition of Deconstructing Dinner, produced and recorded at Nelson, British Columbia's Kootenai Co-op Radio. I've been your host, John Steinman. I thank my technical assistant, Doug Farquharson. The theme music for Deconstructing Dinner is courtesy of Nelson area resident Adam Shake. This radio program is provided free of charge to campus community radio stations across the country and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Support for the program can be donated through our website at cjly.net/deconstructingdinner or by dialing 250-352-9600.